The Met Gala returned triumphantly last night in New York City as the world's most stylish people worked what has become the most prestigious red carpet in fashion. So prestigious, in fact, the carpet isn't even red, it's beige. And the tickets, by the way, are a mere $35,000 a piece. The fundraising event, usually held on the first Monday in May, it was cancelled in 2020 because of COVID, delayed this year for the same reason. But this 2021 event was themed American Independence, co-chaired by fashionable young things Billie Eilish, Timothée Chalamet, the poet Amanda Gorman, and the tennis player Naomi Osaka. So what is the history of the Met Gala? What impact did the year out for the pandemic have on the style that we saw last night? Joining me now is Penny McCormack of The Gloss magazine. Just give us a sense of you know, this started back in 1948, Penny, as a relatively small event, a bit of a fundraiser, but it's grown into something totally different since that, hasn't it? Or something much bigger anyway.
That's right, Sean. Good evening. It was founded in 1948 by publicist Eleanor Lambert, and I think it was a waspish event with, for a mere modest $50 a head. And for that, guests got a nice sedate dinner at the Waldorf Astoria and light entertainment. It changed into something more exotic when Diana Freeland took over as editor of Vogue in 1972. And of course, she was very flamboyant, so she wanted a lot more ambitious exhibitions. And the galas then were a promotional tool for the exhibitions. And I think this model has now been emulated around the world, most notably at London's Victoria and Albert exhibitions.
Yeah, because Vreeland was, we were talking about the Costume Institute at the New Metropolitan Museum of Modern Art back in 1948. Vreeland became the director there, and that's how,
that's
where the money was being raised for. But, you know, we're talking about fashion and we're talking about pageantry here. But when did it tip over into, I mean, certainly from the stuff I was looking at today, there's a real sense of performance involved here, almost performance art, I think you could say, of some of it.
Oh, that's totally right. I think first of all, social media has made it into a pageant. It was originally a big New York event, but now obviously it's an instantaneous event that's broadcast around the world. We can't underestimate the impact that Anna Wintour brought to the whole gala. When she took over as editor of Vogue and a Met trustee in 1995, she deliberately courted celebrity in her magazine, and this is actually reflected on the guest list. I mean, originally, you know, high-profile guests were New York high society. Then it's morphed into global style icons. For example, Jackie O and Diana, Princess of Wales, took part. Now it's a lot more democratic in some ways, but it's evolved from not purely fashion figures, but to, for example, sportswomen, which we saw in last night's event. I think also the documentary First Monday in May from 2016 has driven our interest. We saw behind the scenes, and that was the year that the theme was China Through the Looking Glass, when Sarah Jessica Parker turned up in Philip Tracy, that fabulous headdress, and Rihanna wore that egg yolk dress, that was renamed egg yolk dress by Gove Hay.
Yeah, and you, I mean, Naomi Osaka, one of the what we refer to as the co-chairs of this event.
That's right.
Four of them. Now, how exactly? Obviously, you have to have $35,000 in your back pocket, but is it still a very exclusive invite list? How do you get your way in onto that list?
Well, I think, first of all, it was a smaller guest list this year. It was only 400. And I would think that the Vogue staffers have got a huge input into who attends. I mean, who's been on their cover would be on the first call or edit. I think, obviously, the night was about American fashion, so American fashion designers should have been there. I don't think there were as many as I would have hoped for, but also because the co-chairs were bright young things, I liked the fact that the guests were probably, you know, in a younger millennial age group than they had been before. Obviously, I think big corporations, you know, that the Gucci's and the Chanel's and the Dior's can afford that kind of attendance fee. So there was a lot of, for example, Chanel brought their muses. You know, we saw that fashion houses brought their the young stars and models with them, and they can easily afford that kind of ticket price.
I suppose it's a real shop window. That's what it is. It's a chance to show off what they're doing.
Yeah.
Billy, I suppose one of the things that struck me on the American side of things was Billie Eilish was there as one of the co-chairs, as we mentioned, along with Timothée Chalamet, Amanda Gorman and Naomi Osaka. But her dress was... an Oscar de la Renta piece. She was channeling her inner Marilyn Monroe here.
Yes, that was probably one of the more restrained looks. I quite like that. Definitely, there was lots of frock horrors there too, but it was nice to see some old-fashioned elegance like that from Billy. I liked Amanda Gorman's dress, which was channeling apparently the Statue of Liberty in the night sky, which was very poetic, obviously, in keeping with her.
I was struck by Lil Nas X with his multiple gold outfits, not one, two, but certainly three or four outfits it looked like, which he kind of revealed one by one, but the huge gold cloak that he was brought in like a king or a prince.
I think, well, he sort of channeled a couple of former guests. I don't know whether you recall Lady Gaga in 2019, she sort of bared all in Brandon Maxwell, and she sort of stripped off every so often, revealing sort of less and less. And Billy Porter then was also carried in by six shirtless men wearing a sun gold outfit. You know, I think gold always makes an impact. Yeah. Iman looked fabulous, but that was not really something wearable. It was definitely a showstopper.
What about Kim Kardashian last night, who, if we're talking about bearing all, she was covering all. She had an entirely black outfit, and everything was covered. No, you could see her hair was out the back of it, okay, a long stream like a ponytail coming out of the back. But apart from that, you could see no part of her body, totally covered in material.
Yes, well, apparently it was some reference to bondage, but my personal theory is obviously keeping up with the Kardashians has been axed, so she's got to stay relevant and stay provocative. I just thought that was ridiculous, but that's me.
But it's often the case, isn't it, really, Penny, that as well as being fashion statements, as I said in my introduction, we're looking at political statements that are being made here as well. A lot of talk online about the Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Explain what she was wearing and what the political statement was.
So she was wearing a white gown with red lettering, Tax the Rich, which was a bit ironic because it was only the rich who were able to into the benefit in the first place. Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney's dress said equal rights for women, and then Cara Delevingne, the supermodel, was wearing Dior, which she's done in the past, and this time she had a bustier proclaiming Peg the patriarchy. So, you know, I think using the catwalk for political gain is becoming more and more widespread, and they didn't miss a moment last night.
So a good gala, and glad to see it all back and happening in the way it did for you, Penny.
Well, I think we've been starved of glamour and gossip, and this definitely gave us something to talk about over the coffee break. But I maybe I'm too fuddy-duddy, but I didn't think there was enough old-fashioned elegance from my point of view.
All right. Not enough elegance for you, Penny. But thanks for sharing your thoughts on last night's Met Gala in New York. That's Penny McCormack speaking to us there from the Gloss Magazine. All right. Fela is an Irish singer, songwriter, rapper and producer of Sierra Leonean origin. Her music has been described as future Afro soul, from her 2017 single Like No Other through to last year's four-track EP, Kinematics. Fela has put herself at the front line of Irish hip-hop. Saturday, September the 18th, she will perform a 60-minute set at the Project Arts Centre as part of the Dublin Fringe Festival. She's with me this evening. Let's start with a flavour of her music. First track from her EP, Kinematics, released last year. It's called Fall in Love.
Talking me up, making me feel some kind of way. Oh, no.
Little section there from Fall in Love from last year's four-track EP Kinematics from Fede, who joins me now. I talked to Fede in my introduction about, you know, singer-songwriter, rapper and producer, but didn't mention the fact that you're a multi-instrumentalist. And of course, it's inevitable that I will have to ask you about the astrophysics teaching as well. But just give me an idea of why you were studying astrophysics, and what was the balance between that and music? Was one, did one or other of them have a different function, if you know what I mean, in your life?
Well, I studied astrophysics in Maynooth, and while I was there, I joined the Jazz Society, and that kind of got me gigging a lot. And it was usually every Tuesday night we used to play a gig in Brady's in Maynooth. And it was just a jam, so we didn't really have to practice or rehearse or prepare. We just had to show up. and I guess that just put me in a very creative space. But physics is a very creative subject. You have to be able to be inspired by your own questions and ideas. So the two complement each other quite well.
Yeah, it often strikes me that about science, you know, that we think that, oh, that's all mathematical and it's clinical, A plus B equals C, and that there's no kind of leeway in between. But it is that moment of asking the right question is really the big thing in science, isn't it? If you can ask the right question, then you're heading somewhere. What is it in terms of music and creativity? Is there a starting point there that's similar to astrophysics or to sciences? What would you say?
Well, I mean, maybe not so much a starting point as the process, I feel, is quite similar in that, you know, when you have creative energy, you want to express it in a way that's constructive if your profession is an artist. So that's where the kind of practical, logical part of your brain kicks in, which science utilizes all the time. So I find it very easy to channel my creative energy into a constructive idea because of the training I had in physics, where, you know, you have all of these variables and you have to organize them in your head and figure out how to solve a problem based on the information that you have. And I mean, that's the same thing with creative ideas. There's just a load of them you have and you just need to figure out which ones to use.
Yeah, I've often heard the comparison of, you know, the lion and the cage in terms of the art. Yeah. And, you know, if you have the lion, that's all the emotion and the creativity, if you like. But if you don't have the cage, which is the form, one without the other is kind of an empty cage is a waste of time. A tiger running wild isn't great either. You had planned to move to London in March 2020. That was put on hold for obvious reasons, we know now. But you're now planning to move to Holland. Why Holland?
Yeah, well, I have a lot of friends in Holland and I have a nice little base there. But I have a good few European dates next year, and Holland is one of those places where you can just hop on a train and get anywhere you need to go. So for the purposes of like making it very easy for me to tour in Europe, it'll be nice to be on the continent.
And what about the music scene over there?
The music scene over there is amazing. To be honest, every scene over there is really great, especially in Rotterdam, where I'm going to go. They have the infrastructure there to have all kinds of artists perform or exhibit their work. They have everything can be turned into a gallery space or a nightclub or, you know, a basement kind of techno venue if needs be. So I think there's actually a lot of opportunities there for all kinds of artists. But musically, all of the artists that I love and adore always end up hopping into Rotterdam on the way. They also have the jazz festival there. And then there's a great house and techno scene there, of course, as well.
Yeah, of course. We're back to this idea of the sciences and the arts again, and the logical side. So you've given me all of the great logical reasons there, the great music scene, the great gigs. But I'm guessing there is a bit of romance involved as well. If there's a boyfriend there, that's a big part of the reason for going, is it?
Well, that would be telling. Let's just focus on the practicals for now.
Right, so fair enough. Okay, your sister, of course, Sally, people will know as Loa. Your brother Thomas, both of them also musicians. I know you have four siblings. There's five of you in total. What's it like when you collaborate with Thomas and Sally and that, or Loa in that respect? Is that an easy thing to do?
Yeah, more so than maybe people would imagine. Myself and Sally and Thomas have a very, we kind of, we make a nice Venn diagram when it comes to our taste in music. There's a lot of things that, you know, we each individually like, and there's a lot of stuff that we all like together. So whenever we've had a chance to work together, it's always been good. But it's usually best when one person is kind of in charge. So I've worked on with Thomas on his at his gigs. I've you know, done vocals for him before, and sang his music, and him the same with me, and played guitar with me, and Sally same, vice versa. We've all kind of jumped on each other's gigs, yeah. And that's always really nice. I mean, siblings singing together is always just an amazing thing, and people have often commented on how nice our harmonies sound. So that's always makes me feel good.
And as a child, you moved around quite a bit: Ireland, the UK, West Africa as well, and I mentioned Sierra Leone, obviously as a country of origin. Yeah. I presume all of that is, even in the piece of Fall in Love that we heard, there are a lot of musical influences in there.
Yeah, there are. That would probably be you've summarized all of the various places where I get my influences from. So yeah. I'm glad it can be heard in the music.
Right, let's finish up with the track. I presume we'll be getting some of these pieces at your Fringe Festival show. Tell me a little bit about the two-body problem, which is the piece that we're going to finish up by listening to Feather, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, this is a song I actually had a feature on. Her name is Celarita Mai. She does the rap. There's a verse in it that she does there. This song was, the original sample is something I rustled up from an Umu Sangare piece of music. I kind of sampled and kind of messed around with some of the kora playing that she has. Or it's actually an Ngoni, a little slightly smaller kora, which is a kind of West African harp.
Right.
And she has a lot of that in her music. She's a Wasulu, she's from the Wasulu tribe. And in their music, they use a lot of that kind of, it's a very percussive sounding harp, if you will. And I adore it. And I started out the song by using that sample, and then it kind of turned into a classic Feta jam.
Moved on from there.
Lots of kick drums and lots of beats, yeah.
Listen, great to speak with you, Feta. And
Thank you so much.
Not at all. I'll give people the details of the Fringe Festival show. But first of all, let's have a listen to Two Body Problem. Not another man to dictate the shape, darling, your confidence is a mistake. When they say the liking king's much thicker, I agree, curves and swerves but bigger. Not another man to dictate the shape, darling, your confidence. The rapping there of Celavi Demai, along with the singing of Feta from that song, Two Body Problem. And Feta will be at the Space Upstairs in the Project Arts Centre this Saturday, September the 18th, as part of the Dublin Fringe Festival. Full details on fringefest.com. Belfast-born composer Brian Irvine's work has frequently involved collaborations with artists from a variety of disciplines, including Seamus Heaney, Joanna McGregor, David Holmes and Matthew Bourne. Should come as no surprise then that the artist Brian would like most to introduce us to is John Zorn, avant-garde composer renowned for his collaborative work. And Brian Irvine with me in studio this evening. It was Rolling Stone that said, Brian, although John Zorn has operated almost entirely outside of the mainstream, he's gradually asserted himself as one of the most influential musicians of our time. Who are we talking about when we talk about John Zorn, and why is he so influential?
Okay, so John Zorn was really a sort of multi-instrumentalist, composer, improviser, saxophone player, maybe coming off the back of a sort of jazz orientation. But I guess what he is at heart is a sort of fanatic about all aesthetics of music and how those aesthetics of music can be combined, disrupted, connected. And his whole approach to composition is really about a sort of cut and paste, using chunks of sound, chunks of references in an overall arching theme. So I guess why he's so important, I guess, is because he broke down the elements of composition into different kinds of things, whereas composers before would talk about note sets and rhythms and cells and so on that you develop. Zorn's music is about sort of little captured sound worlds that would, you know, from film or country or jazz or rock or classical. And he used these little chunks of sound worlds to combine together in a kind of cut and paste way, but not actually cut and paste, so that often the sonorities of the chunks will spill over
you overlap know? Into each other.
Exactly.
I want to play a piece from a John Zorn composition. Forbidden Fruit is the title here, and it has. We've got to remember that we're talking about these chunks of sound or sonorities, if you like. Yeah. Some of them are ugly sonorities, and as you'll hear, some of them...
You might say that, you know, I might say...
Some of them are challenging sonorities, let me put it that way. And some of them are melodically are a little bit easier to get your head around. So bear with the opening minute or so of Forbidden Fruit and you'll get a bit of both. A little bit of Carmen creeping in there. That's what's creeping in there. So he's not. That's John Zorn and a piece called Forbidden Fruit. And I wanted to play that as a starting. It's Brian Irvine who's speaking to us about the American composer this evening. I wanted to play that to start out, Brian, because it does give us a real sense of this. When you listen to that scraping sound at the beginning, you're going, what is that? And I asked you first thing when we were listening, what is that? And what was it, that scraping sound?
Well, it's a string quartet, and it's just the string quartet playing in different kind of extended techniques. But there's also Christian Markley in there, who's on turntables, and he's kind of using some string quartet records to mash into it, you know. And So if you look at the score of it, it's kind of all written out and it's shapes and all sorts of things.
Yeah, I wish people could see your hands and you're describing that. Yeah, it's pretty much like
radio for you.
you put your hands are moving around in the fashion of the music itself. But then it does go into that. Beautiful melodic section. So it's not that he's saying, oh no, it always has to be atonal. It always has to be.
No, I mean, see that. I think that's the interesting thing, you know, because I actually don't believe in anything called atonality. I don't believe in anything to do with nasty sounds, horrible sounds, hard to take sounds. I mean, we live in this kind of utopian world where we're surrounded by noise all the time, you know, and some of those noises you connect to, some of them you don't. And everyone connects the sound in a different way, you know. So I think what Zorn does, it's kind of like a John Cage thing. He says everything is valid, you know. Everything is potent, you know, and we can build on these things. We can connect. There's no hierarchy between country music or classical music or rock music or house music or turntables. It's this, we live in this mashed up, intricately connected world.
Yeah. And to think that you can just have one element and say, that's the only sound there is in the world, beautiful string quartet playing legato melodies.
Exactly.
That's not
And
that's
I,
not
think,
being
I think that's, in many ways, is his genius, you know, because it's kind of that he embraces that philosophy to such an extent that the works can be so overwhelming in some ways, you know, because we're just not used to that.
We talked about collaborations. Spillane was inspired by the novels and films of the hard-boiled crime writer Mickey Spillane. Yeah. Now, it's interesting how John Zorn went about creating these pieces. They're almost dramatizations, they feel like to me, musical dramatizations, not straightforward narrative dramatizations, but something else.
No, I mean, what he does is he responds to the overall narrative, what's in Spillane. So he would be reading articles, he'd obviously be watching, he'd be listening to the soundtrack, listening to things, and literally just snatching moments or elements of that and responding to them. So that might be written, notated music, it might be shapes, it might be colours, it might be drawings, it might be just directions, do this, do that. You know, it might be just reflecting what's happening, say, in one of the episodes. Man gets knocked down by a car, man gets knocked down by a car. And then you have to make that.
Make that sound somehow.
Yeah, exactly, you know.
Well, let's have a listen to the opening section then of this piece from Spillane. And again, remember, we're thinking of a hard-boiled crime fiction novel here. And this is what one of those would sound like if it wasn't a hard-boiled crime fiction novel. There's a little section there from Spillane, the composition of John Zorn, and it's a Belfast composer, Brian Irvine, who's with me in studio this evening, giving us an idea of where we might begin with the music of Zorn. But that, it really is, you know, how would that appear on the page? What would you see on the score for that, Brian?
What you'd see is scream line, and then it'll be a kind of swing riff. Vamp kind of thing, and his. I mean, the other key thing about Zorn is that like many composers, he will work with a very specific group of musicians. You know, so he'll be able to say, play a kind of a jazz swing thing, and then that'll be enough. But the next cue, and Spillane, the cues are bigger, longer, you know. But he works with a very specific group of musicians, so, and that's part of his aesthetic, in the same way that, you know, Duke Ellington would work to his, you know, Frank Zappa, you know, same group of people. Allowing their
But collaborations always sounds like, oh, could we try this out, please? And could we try? I think he was a little bit more forthright in his way of communicating.
He definitely was like, he was a ballsy New Yorker, you know, and he was like any sort of producer or something. He knew what he wanted, and actually, he was drawing from just this enormous. There's a great documentary about him. I think it's called On Edge, but it was, and you can see the sheer volume of his record. Collection, it's enormous, you know, and his references are very accurate. So although he can say, I want this, do this, do this, do this, he's drawn from a big pool of knowledge, you know.
We'll finish up just talking about Zorn by listening to a little bit of the Torture Garden, Naked City. What's involved here?
Torture Garden is a really unique album. It's a series, I think it's about 53 miniatures, and he works with a lot of different musicians, but there's a kind of, it's kind of like a hardcore jazz napalm death punk miniature onslaught.
Just that's all that's involved. Let's have a listen.
I don't think there's a track that lasts more than like a minute and a half.
I just love the way, you know, you think, that is a straightforward heavy metal rock. That's what I'm listening to there. And then it goes into those crazy little sections. That's John Zorn, Torture Garden.
Yeah. I mean, that's what's so beautiful about it, John, is because, like, you know, it's kind of part serious, part cartoon. Like, I mean, that's just like Wile E. Coyote to me or something, you know. It's just kind of bounces from that to that. Mm. And it's like the surprise, it's the disruption, it's the excitement, it's about turning everything on its head, you know.
We heard there during the break about your own opera, at least like the other currently running at the O'Reilly Theatre in Belvedere College. Has Zorn, do you think he's influenced you, particularly in that piece, the story of Rosemary Kennedy, of course?
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I think he's influenced everything I've ever done in many ways, because that opera is a kind of a layering of stuff. We layer, you know, mezzo-soprano, we layer actors, we layer a 12-piece ensemble, and another ensemble here, an improvising ensemble. So I conduct one ensemble, and Fergus Shield conducts the other ensemble. We use text, narration, speech, video, and we mash it all up. So there's a kind of a Zorn aspect to it.
It's not cut and paste, but it's what you're talking about. It's the same as the Zorn idea.
And it's kind of fragmentary. Like when I was writing Least Like the Other, I wrote it in fragments, you know, and in the end I wrote something like 38, 39 fragments, of which we then utilised, I think, 14 in the opera, you know. But it's this idea of responding to stuff, in the same way that Zorn would respond to Spillane. I was responding to things that I was finding out about Rosemary, text, letters I was uncovering, documentation, film, just bits and pieces of stuff, you know.
And of course it's a fragmented story in that it was often she was kind of the hidden of the Kennedy children, really, wasn't it? So it kind of suits that type of treatment. Well, thanks for coming into us, Brian, giving us your thoughts in and around John Zorn. I will be off to do a little bit more exploring, certainly, into that soundscape.
Come to the opera.
I'll get more of it there. That's Brian Irving there, and the Irish National Opera's production of Least Like the Other, based on the life of Rosemary Kennedy. It runs at the O'Reilly Theatre in Belvedere College through until September the 18th. Socially distanced seating is available, and you can get full details on irishnationalopera.ie. Now, as the saying goes, no good deed goes unpunished. That's certainly the case with Greek myths. Carol Gebler's new novel, I, Antigone, is a retelling of the Oedipus myth, dictated to a scribe. by Oedipus's daughter Antigone. In the retelling of the famous story of the man who solved the riddle of the Sphinx and was destined to murder his father, marry his mother, the novel presents mythical events from 2,500 years ago as if they were today's daily news. And just like today's news, what is considered truth is constantly under question. I, Antigone, is a novel about what is to feel bound to fate, the efforts we make to avoid doing the wrong thing, how our lives are often shaped by unseen historical forces, and the dangers of ignoring history. Lots to talk about with Carlo Gebler, who joins me on the line right now. Carlo, I suppose just to lay it out there, because we all know the Greek myths, but we get them all mixed up. But the Oedipus one, I think, is probably the best known of them all, because we always hear the Oedipus complex or the Oedipal complex. Just give us the nuts and bolts of Oedipus and the awful situation he found himself in, really, at the heart of this story.
It's a myth about a couple, Laius and Jocasta. And because of Laius's, the bad things that he's done, he's told that his son will kill him if he has a son with Jocasta. She gets pregnant. There is a son. Oh, dear. What are they going to do? They give the baby to a shepherd to leave on a mountainside to die. But the shepherd, what shepherd wants to leave a baby to die? He gives it to another shepherd, who takes the baby to Corinth, where the baby grows up into a fine young man, who then is told he's going to kill his father and marry his mother. He thinks his adoptive parents are those victims. Mm. So he flees. And of course, the person he does actually kill is, though he doesn't know it, his father Laius, and the woman he marries, though he doesn't know it, is his mother, Jocasta.
And so his daughter Antigone is at once his half-sister and his daughter, which is enough to give anybody the heebie-jeebies, let's face it. But on two occasions when you were giving us the bones of the story there, Carlo, you, interestingly, you used in terms of Laius, the beginning of the story, you said he's told, and then of Oedipus you told us he's told. This is the oracle who's doing all this telling. If you think of a 21st century audience saying, oh, there's some oracle that's going to tell us everything that's going to happen in the future, that's a tough ask for a 21st century reader or audience to take on board, is it?
Well, perhaps we could say Fox News is that oracle for certain people. I could name other culprits. What's interesting about this story is that it gets at the duality of human experience. On the one hand, we do what we do. We choose to do it. We act, we believe freely. On the other hand, there is so much that we do that is programmed. In the past, in the Greek past, that which was preordained was thought of in terms of fate, which controlled destiny. Usually a curse would be issued, and that would predetermine what would happen. But what's interesting about the Oedipus story, and in fact all Greek myth, which involves the interplay between action and what the Delphic oracle predicts, is that even though it predicts, people will choose to do what they do. Oedipus freely chooses to kill Laius. Now, had he stopped to think, had he asked the Delphic oracle a different question, if different ifs had come into play, he wouldn't have done that. But he does choose to refuse to step out of the way of Laius's carriage on the highway to Delphi, and a row ensues, and he kills not only Laius, but three other men. Mm. I mean, he goes completely ballistic. The red mist descends. And there are very good reasons why the red mist descends. It's like all Greek myth, it's psychologically utterly plausible. But at the same time, he is Oedipus, acting out what has been foretold. And I look around the modern world and I think, that's our story now. We think we're free. We are free. and yet we're not free.
So, in some ways, you're making, I suppose, you're drawing a direct parallel between the oracle at Delphi telling everybody back in Greek mythology what was going to happen, and the news bulletins that we listen to today. It doesn't matter what the organisation is, you're going to have you have to have critical ears on you, no matter what you're listening to, to get at the truth. At the point of choosing to write the Oedipus story and to retell the story, let's face it, it's been told more than once down through history.
Yeah.
At the point of choosing to write about it, are you already thinking in those, in terms of those contemporary parallels, or can you afford to let them into your brain, into your mind as you write?
Oh, no, the entire book was catalyzed by fretfulness, rage, despair, despondency about the modern world. And the only way to, it seemed to me, address it is by going slantwise at it. It's the old idea, you couldn't cut off the Medusa's head directly, because if you looked at her, she'd turn you to stone. Hercules had to hold a mirror up and look at the image in the mirror and let that guide his actions.
So inevitably,
old stories are a mirror.
So inevitably, when you're writing about the past, you're writing about this very moment in time as well.
Absolutely, yes. Absolutely. It's. I don't think the world is in a very good place at the moment. And we can write realistic fiction or realistic non-fiction. That's one way of addressing it. But the great thing about mythical stories is that they relieve you of the burden of realism. And you are able to escape into the realm of essentials.
The way that the novel is presented, it's Antigone is telling the story to a scribe to write down. It's very difficult not to think of that scribe as being Carlo Gebler in some way, shape or form. I mean, is that how you write? Was there a voice of Antigone literally at your ear, a kind of a monkey on your shoulder saying, you've got to write this down, you've got to write this down, you've got to write this down? Because that's what she keeps telling the scribe.
Mm. Yes. Once you ascribe responsibility for a text to someone else, to a character, to a voice, once you give them the baton to hold, as a writer, you're liberated. All you do is transcribe. You just tune into the voice that's in the head and off you go. It liberates you. By ascribing the writing to Antigone, I am liberated from having to be Carlo Gebler. I don't have to make anything up. She does it all.
And you say...
I just write it down.
You say liberated there. Is that close to abdication? Or are they two related?
I would say... That's a very interesting word, abdication. Yes, you cede responsibility for the fiction to something else. Now, that something else is a shard of your own personality. Obviously, it's something that is indwelling within you, but it's also not of you. And also, because you've ceded responsibility, or as you would say, abdicated, a very good word, you're liberated. You don't have to go, I don't think we could have a snake with, or a serpent with gold teeth that are taken out and planted in the ground and grow into warriors. That doesn't matter. That is how Antigone sees the world.
Any particular,
and she sees the world.
Any particular,
you know, she sees gods.
Yeah, any particular reason that it was Antigone you chose to tell this story? It could have come from several of the family, obviously, or other members of the family at any rate, or Oedipus himself.
I think it has to be her, because she herself is the story fits inside her story. And her story, as everyone knows from the Theban plays, is that she, her brothers go to war. Eteocles kills Polynices. The body is left to rot by the orders of Creon. She buries the body because you can't leave the dogs to chew over a corpse. And of course, Creon has decreed that whoever buries the body will in turn suffer punishment. So she gets the story in before she goes off to meet her own destiny.
And important that she records that story, which leads me on to my final question in terms of recording and records. The archive of your mother, the writer Edna O'Brien, that archive from 2009 to 2021 has been acquired by the National Library. How important a moment is that for you and for all of you as a family?
We need to keep the past. You can't let these things go. And we need the sort of papery product of the working life is of inestimable value. And it's incredibly valuable. And it is a very, very good thing that the state have acquired it and that they've kept it in the country rather than it going to, Austin, Texas or somewhere else, like so often these materials go. But you will never understand the present or be able to face the future unless you're familiar with the past. And in that archive, there's a lot of the past of Ireland.
Yeah, for sure. And I suppose that's what your novel is about as well. And lovely to speak with you about it this evening. Carlo Gebler there, author of I, Antigone, which is published by New Ireland.